Hello, my name is Ben Burrell and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that takes an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. If you haven't heard the first two parts to this episode, I'd advise you go back and listen to them first, just so we're all on the same page, and part three is coming up very, very shortly. First though, let me quickly remind you, we have a website on there at the moment. There's some Bob Dylan playlists we've tailor-made you might want to have a look at. You can find them, bobdylanpodcast.com, and of course, we are on Instagram and Twitter. If you haven't followed us already, give us a follow, it really helps us out. You can find us at Bob Dylan Podcast. So on with part number three, which concerns a record that for many is one of the greatest albums ever made. It will become an icon's masterpiece, but will be born out of some heartache. This is Blood on the Tracks.
The festival was over and the boys were all planning for a ball. The cabaret was quiet except for the drilling in the wall. The curfew had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway looking like the Jack of Hearts.
As we heard on the first two parts of this episode, this album feels like a personal story of woe, and it's all about the breakdown of a relationship with more than a hint that it details the breakdown of a marriage. On first inspection, it's easy to link these songs to Dylan's own marriage, which would end in divorce in 77. While that's a two-year gap between the album's release and the divorce, it's fair to say that Dylan and his then-wife Sarah were definitely experiencing problems around the time of the album cycle. In fact, in an interview talking about his creative process for the album, which was transformed by art lessons he was taking in New York, Bob goes on to say that this changed his relationship too. He says, "I went home after the classes and my wife never did understand me since that day. That's when our marriage really started breaking up. She never knew what I was about or what I was talking about, and I couldn't possibly explain it." This breakdown was so severe that Bob had even started to see other people, including Columbia Records employee Ellen Bernstein, who spent a lot of time with Dylan during the album's inception. All of this must have had some influence over these songs, and after repeated listens, it becomes easy to spot. From the open discussion of marriage and affairs on track 4 Idiot Wind to the even more transparent discarded take Call Letter Blues, which would eventually appear on the first Bootleg Series album. In the lyrics for this song, it feels like he's directly addressing his wife, especially that line of, "Well, children cry for mother, I tell them, mother took a trip." This song would obviously not make it onto the record. It would come instead in the form of the very similar sounding track 6, Meet Me in the Morning, and in doing so would shift away from this raw portrait of a missing mother and wife to instead feel more like a song about overcoming demons. In fact, Meet Me in the Morning plays a pivotal role on the record's story in that loose album narrative I've mentioned in other parts of this episode, where we move through the different stages and emotions of a breakup. With this track, we're moving away from the angry stage of a tune like Idiot Wind to a state of realization, all via a brief moment of reconciliation in the form of "You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go." The author Michael Gray calls Meet Me in the Morning a tense, multi-layered struggle between the lashing out and stepping back, and I couldn't agree more. This song, it feels like our narrator has been up all night thinking and is finally at a place where he feels he can move on. The "little rooster crowing, there's something on his mind" lyric is the perfect metaphor for his situation. The use of the word crowing has a lonely feeling about it, usually because the rooster crow is the first thing that happens in the morning, breaking up the silence of that part of the day, and is done completely on his own. But it also strikes an agitated note too. It's not a happy or contented sound, it's more of a frustrated noise. And of course, it plays into the song's theme of waiting for the morning too, with the rooster's daybreak nature. We can also view that lyric as a line in the sand moment. That crowing from the rooster marks the start of a new dawn, literally, and here it feels like the start of a new dawn for our narrator, metaphorically. It's a moment where he finally puts a line in the sand under the end of the relationship. Elsewhere, the lyric of crawling through barbed wire represents the struggle he's had with this particular form of love before we finally arrive at the key line of "They say the darkest hour is right before the dawn," reaffirming that his struggle is about to come to an end, but our narrator is still trying to get through his last final moments of difficulty. This song is the only surviving cut from Weisberg's Deliverance Group, who, as I mentioned in part two of this episode, were fired a matter of days into their session. It's also rare in the fact that it saw the use of overdubs. Bob is famous for cutting songs live, even right up to recent records like Modern Times. Here, though, he uses the elements from the Call Letter Blues backing track with overdubbed vocals, and it works really well. It's probably one of the best recorded songs on the album. The mixing and overall tone here are much more advanced sounding than, say, Tangled Up in Blue with its slightly ramshackle live cut appearance. Listen to how the acoustic, drums, pedal steel and electric guitars all feel quite compartmentalised. This is all underpinned by that light, almost jamming bass line. Ain't that just like my heart, babe? When you kiss my lips. I love the 12-bar blues sound moulded by that electric guitar, which buzzes with an almost menace. And again, unusually for Bob, we have a repeated riff on the acoustic guitar, which is actually quite intricate. Dylan was obviously never a guitar player like Hendrix, but this is perhaps one of his most underrated riffs. It's got a great rhythm and really acts as a solid base to build the song on. It's also the main source of the song's hint of classic country, something that's built upon with Buddy Cage's steel guitar. It's often overlooked, but I feel this song might be the most sonically interesting one on the entire record. As well as that country feel here, there's definitely more of a 70s vibe too. You couldn't particularly picture this on any of Dylan's 60s records, and that's a good thing in this context. Bob was moving away from his old sound slowly but surely. Away from that instrumentation, it's hard to see any autobiographical references in this particular track. Interestingly though, the first and only time this was performed live by Bob was in 2007. 3 decades after its initial release, indicating that perhaps Dylan either wasn't happy with the song or it contained something he'd rather forget, which becomes quite the mystery. In fact, just to put it into context, he's performed And It Stoned Me by Van Morrison more times live than this song from his masterpiece. And it stoned me to my soul. Stoned me just like jelly rolls. And it stoned me. Regardless of this song's lack of love from Bob live, Meet Me in the Morning is in stark contrast to its preceding track, which, Whisper It, has some happiness about it. The rosy harmonica and upbeat guitar strum of You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go finish the first half of the album, breaking that heartache and bitterness with, finally, a bit of joy. I've seen love go by my door. It's never been this close before. Never been so easy or so slow. I've been shooting in the dark too long. When something's not right, it's wrong. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go. This track offers a nice bit of variation and some breathing space from the album's context, but also manages to stay well within the themes. This was taken from the New York sessions and, like so many others from there, is incredibly stripped back. Away from that harmonica-laced intro, just listen to how rudimentary the sonics are on verse 2. There's hardly anything going on, just a guitar and a meandering bass, and then Dylan's vocals. Dragon clouds so high above, I've only known careless love. It always has hit me from below. But this time round it's more correct. Right on target, so direct. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go. To my ears, it's just one guitar with a bit of reverb. They haven't double-tracked anything, and Bob's vocal is pretty bare too. There's just a touch more reverb accentuating its features. It's the same elsewhere as well, on tracks like Shelter from the Storm. In fact, the production there is almost a carbon copy. 'Twas in another lifetime, one of toil and blood.
when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Situations have ended sad, relationships have all been bad. Mine have been like Verlaine's and Rambo. But there's no way I can compare all them scenes to this affair. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go.
This lack of production to hide behind really shows the craft of these songs. They're not dressed up, but they still manage to become classics. There's no need to employ any tricks. They can stand up by themselves, and that kind of suits the subject matter perfectly. These songs speak directly to the listener on themes that most people have experienced. They're very relatable, and the best way to accentuate that is in the most direct medium possible. Here, that's Bob with a guitar and a microphone and not a lot else. And here with this song, we have that in abundance. In fact, it stays the same pretty much for the whole tune until we eventually get the return of that harmonica at the end. The lyrics here are much more placid than elsewhere on the album. Gone is the nervous tension of Idiot Wind and the desolation of the Other Side One tracks. Here we're reminded of the joy of love as Dylan sings contented lyrics like flowers on the hillside blooming crazy, crickets talking back and forth in rhyme, blue river running slow and lazy, I could stay with you forever and never realise the time. The comparison of love to nature in this song does many things. It helps to give it a power that cannot be contained, like it's wild and ever-present, but it also gives it a sense of natural beauty, something that can't be engineered or created, and at the same time can't be controlled. I also love that line of never realise the time, again about the power of love being so robust it could stop time. In the next verse, he reminds us of the album's previous feelings with lines like situations have ended sad, relationships have all been bad, and but there's no way I can compare all those scenes to this affair. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go.
Situations have ended sad, relationships have all been bad. Mine have been like Verlaine's and Rambo. But there's no way I can compare all them scenes to this affair. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go.
On that album timeline, this song feels like a reconciliation between our lovers. It's almost dreamlike, like it might not actually be happening. It could even be viewed that this is the dream before we get the next track, Meet Me in the Morning's stark reality check, like this is the night before and that's the morning after. Even Dylan's delivery plays into this. There's a warmness to his vocals and a more animated enunciation too, the direct opposite to the preceding track, Idiot Wind's spat verses. He's even shifted away from that song's accusatory tone to looking at his own actions as he sings, you're gonna make me give myself a good talking to.
You're gonna make me wonder what I'm saying. You're gonna make me give myself a good talking to. I look for you.
It would appear a narrator is questioning his angry acts during the breakup and is now having doubts. Doubts that would eventually be cast away and Meet Me in the Morning. In reality, there's more than enough evidence that Dylan wrote this about Bernstein. The next lyric in the song, the one that starts verse 3, appears to recall an incident between them as he sings, purple clover, Queen Anne lace, crimson hair across your face. Bernstein says this is about time spent on Dylan's Minnesota farm whilst he was writing the album. She's quoted as saying, I remember when we were walking in the field somewhere and I found a Queen Anne lace and he didn't know what it was called. Elsewhere, there's a mention of looking for someone in Old Honolulu, San Francisco, Ashtabula. Bernstein says, I lived in San Francisco, Honolulu, San Francisco, Ashtabula. To put that in a song, it's so ridiculous, but it's also very touching.
I look for you in Old Honolulu, San Francisco, or Ashtabula. You're gonna have to leave me now, I know. But I see you in the sky above, in the tall grass, and the ones I love. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go.
There's also a great line about being in the tall grass with the ones I love, which could be referring to Bernstein playing with Dylan's children on Bob's farm, something that she mentions happening during the early stages of the writing process. Of course, we can never be 100% sure if this is true, and it does sound uncharacteristically transparent and autobiographical for Bob, but at the same time, does appear to fit the bill, leading us to conclude that perhaps not all the songs here concern just Bob's relationship with his wife, something that becomes more and more apparent when you look at the other songs in detail. For example, track 2, Simple Twist of Fate, appears to be about former girlfriend Susie, made famous for appearing on the cover of the Freewheeling LP. Its subtitle was Fourth Street Affair, named after the apartment at 161 W and 4th, where the two had lived. Also, as a side note, that apparently was the working title for Positively 4th Street as well, meaning perhaps these two songs could be linked, one glowing with red-hot anger at Dylan's treatment for becoming successful, and the other looking back years later with sadness at lost friends from that time. This is strengthened further when we consider the lyrics discussed in part one of this episode about the song's final verse, as the narrator shifts to being in the first person, talking in the present day, having looked back over his past in the previous verses.
People tell me it's a sin to know and feel too much within. I still believe she was my twin, but I lost the rain. She was born in spring, but I was born too late. Blame it on this simple twist of fate.
The idea that Susie is the subject of the song is almost confirmed by Bob when he performed the song in London on the 30th of June 1981, changing the lyrics to, "He walked along through the city blocks. All the time he remembers Susie when she talks. Hunts her down by the waterfront docks where the sailors all roll in." This might have been Bob forgetting himself on stage, or feeling like it was okay to open up after all these years, or even perhaps just adding a bit of mystery to the song. But it would appear this song and these songs have a more than tenuous connection to his personal life. There is, of course, some objection to this too. In his 2004 memoir, Chronicles Volume 1, Dylan stated these songs have nothing to do with his personal life and they're inspired by short stories from Anton Chekhov. Elsewhere, there's a story from songwriter Stephen Soles saying that in 1977, Dylan came over unannounced to his apartment and played him 10 or 12 songs that were very dark and very intense, dealing with the bitterness over his divorce. None of these songs were ever recorded, leading us to think that perhaps that could have been Bob exercising his demons over his marriage rather than on Blood on the Tracks. Having said that, he would do just that on the next LP's closing track, titled Sarah.
Change your mind, Sarah, Sarah. So easy to look at, so hard to define.
He's so open here, coming out in the song and stating who the subject is, even putting her name in the title and referring to other songs he's written for her. This might be a reaction to all the talk surrounding Blood on the Tracks, but it's quite the stark contrast, leading us to think that maybe if he was willing to do that elsewhere, Blood on the Tracks isn't as personal as we first thought. However, to contradict that once again, this could also be a double bluff. As a listener, it's hard to shake the feeling that Dylan is covering these songs in a little mystery to protect himself. There's some evidence of this too. The two most painful songs that would appear to concern Sarah, You're a Big Girl Now and If You See Her Say Hello, were both re-recorded in Minneapolis and edited a little with some minor word changes, most of which toned down the feelings and intimacy, which could be Dylan deliberately glossing over any autobiographical nature. Further to this, his son Jacob says, "When I'm listening to Blood on the Tracks, that's about my parents." We also get the feeling of that in the album's title too. The spilling of blood indicates painful incidences, and the use of blood has obvious personal connotations, especially when we think of the phrase, blood is thicker than water. The use of the word tracks indicates a journey, possibly a long one, like a painful long journey of life where blood has been spilled. While this is only speculation, it would appear the album's title is more abstract. The only mention of blood we have in any of the songs is the bitter end of Idiot Wind, which doesn't really match the title.
You heard the words that I'm the best and cover up the truth with lies. One day you'll be in the ditch, flies buzzing around your eyes, blood on your saddle.
As to where we are at the end of the sessions regarding Dylan's personal life, it would appear that Bernstein and Bob had drifted apart. She says, "We became less involved after the sessions. He was down here, I was up there, and he wasn't terribly communicative. I was left to do a lot of guessing, but it was definitely on the downswing. When I did go and see him, it didn't have the same flavour as it did before. It's actually quite apt for this breakup record to have a relationship start at the beginning of the sessions and finish around the album's release. There would also be reconciliation between Dylan and Sarah. She would turn up unannounced later on a tour, presumably to reclaim her husband, and he would perform the track Sarah over Talkback to her during the Desire sessions, rekindling their love before the eventual divorce. As a side note, it also appears they stay amicable in later years. A photo she took of Dylan even appears in the cover art for the Infidels album. They will forever be bound in the public consciousness by this record, which may or may not be true. And while she might not be the main subject for the album as first thought, their situation has to have played some role here. I don't think it's as easy to say this record is wholly autobiographical, but there's certainly parts that feel like they are. Regardless, as a listener, we get some truly exceptional songwriting and some performances, which we can now view as classics. But where can we view it in the grand scheme of greatest records ever made? That's something we look at in part four, next time.
Buckets of rain, buckets of tears, got all them buckets coming out of my ears, buckets of moonbeams in my hand. You got all the love, honey, baby, I can stand.
Thank you for listening to this episode. As I said last time, it's been a real joy making these and going over this album with a fine-tooth comb. I hope you've been enjoying them too. If you did like it, then feel free to give us a rating if you can do. As usual, we're very partial to 5 and 4 stars. And also, again, if wherever you're listening allows you to, then feel free to subscribe or follow us. Until next time, thank you once again for listening and goodbye.